Blog Talk Radio.
Tell my baby naked hat. Ride the cock till you hit the spot. Tell my baby naked hat.
Doing it doggy style.
Wow, 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 yippee yo, yippee yay, bow, wow, yippee yo, yippee yo. Wow, 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 yippee yo, yippee yay, bow, wow, yippee yo, yippee yo.
And welcome to a dramatically different world here at Naked Zuma's Eye Contact Radio.
Oh, my
Jose,
God.
Jose, Jose, Jose. Jose in the highest, yes.
Yeah, that was
a three-run homer. Let it rain in Queens, please. These flippin' Phillies are giving me an ulcer. Wow. ADD Radio has begun. I have had it with just about everything that goes on this planet. But that little pop fly that landed over the fence makes it all better.
Mm-hmm.
You know what it is? We got to talk about this week because we're going to be discussing a lot of weird, kind of abstract topics. And it for the audience's purposes, they don't know what the hell's coming next because how would they? We don't even know if we're going to be on the air in 5 minutes because of the storm.
That's right.
So let's just give the five or six of you sapes that are listening. Actually, the last couple weeks, we had about 50 people listening live.
Yep.
Told a couple of friends and so on.
Mm-hmm.
If the show begins to become silent, that is because Professor Val's house has been hit by lightning and there's no power in the area because she pays by electricity by the minute up there. And
it's unbelievable.
It's about, 1847, where she lives, and they have to keep those little gerbils running really fast to keep the whole thing, turbines going.
The hail was the size of elephant testicles.
Interesting.
And I'm afraid to go out and look at my car.
Well, be afraid. Be very afraid. I was.
Mm-hmm.
I was sure.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I can't believe it raised us to that. That just changed. We're going to discuss this a lot today because we're going to be talking a lot about language and things like that, but and this new controversy that's still brewing,
mm-hmm.
Michael Savage with the autism thing. I just turned him in on the way back, and it's funny how you say something and you mean something else. That's what this guy's going through, and we're going to get into that a little bit because a lot of the stuff we're going to be talking about today is the limits of language. We
mm-hmm.
have been talking about limits for about 6-7 weeks, and we know because Christopher and I live with the shackles of many limits. And we do like to test our boundaries, don't we, as ecos?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Boundaries. I spin on boundaries.
Yeah. We don't need no stinking boundaries. Maybe some speed bumps or some guardrails or something. I don't know.
Yeah, or an occasional fever like I had, yesterday.
Well, you had to burn through that, and that's just your process, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
But what would the life coach call it, a challenge?
Yeah, challenge this, pal.
Yeah, well... Yeah, we have been knocking over a lot of these sacred cows. We started with therapy with Stephen Hayes, and his summary was, what was that?
That was the African Grey, Gracie.
Oh, what the? Could you keep your animals quiet for one show?
Apparently
not. She
doesn't
show them. It's like a pet cemetery, the freaking sanatorium up there.
Mm-mm.
Dogs barking, parrots chirping. Jesus.
They talk, you know.
Oh, yeah, my stomach growl.
Shut the F up.
They could call the show at, to tell us that, just call 646-478-4847. Have your parent call. We'll put them on. I can take what little I get. So we started talking about the limits of therapy because that's where you started with your frustrations with psychology, was that the model was so stuck in its pathology-based mentality, and the application, as we're going to talk a little bit about with our guest tonight, is economically, it doesn't make sense for someone to do their job well in psychotherapy because the client goes bye-bye.
Yeah.
So see, the thing is that with allopathic or conventional medicine, you have something called the drug store, the over-the-counter drugs, and the pharmacist. Wouldn't it be great if you had a whole profession out there, an ancillary profession, that did nothing but pickle your patients between sessions? It'd be like... paying Bonto to go over to somebody's house and go and making them feel guilty between sessions so they go back for another therapy session.
Perfect.
Shouldn't you be doing something constructive? Do your mother go over like every hour in the hour and tell them that? Between
that
sessions. Yeah, like take the giant eco. Just go over and tell them, shouldn't you be doing something to honor your wife right now? Maybe curling up in a ball. Professional naggers, that's what we need. So we talked about that with Stephen Hayes, and he gave us the bromide, which is a perfect one, that people suffer. Here's the news. People suffer. And your happiness isn't normal.
Mm-hmm.
And by just doing that, the whole acceptance and commitment therapy is really about not pedestalizing negativity, but just not ignoring it and not expecting it to go away, go bye, forever and ever. Because people go to therapy thinking that they're going to get some type of bulletproof psychological vest that they can go outside and go, I'm impervious to pain of all types now, you know. And really what it is about making a distinction between true emotional pain and self-inflicted emotional pain. That's really all therapy is. And when you're getting into long-term psychology and you know, these things people like, you know, Woody Allen are going to for 30, 40 years, it really doesn't involve change. I don't think Freud ever intended it to be that way, but economically, that's when you create a profession out of the primordial soup that is the human psyche. You know, guess what? 30-year mortgage, 30-year therapy. You know,
one of the good things that did come out of therapy, though, way, way back in the day, is the invention of the vibrator. Did you know that that's where that started?
Well,
yeah,
I did not know that, but thank you for sharing.
Hysterical women had to be soothed by having an orgasm at the doctor's office, and that's what the therapist used to do. So then instead of, you know, getting carpal tunnel syndrome, mm-hmm. which is how they used to give them, they invented the vibrator, which was like the size of a room at one time.
The size of a what? A worm?
Room.
A room?
It was a huge contraption. Yeah, I'll send you a picture. You'll be fascinated by the...
Entertainment at its finest here on Naked Soma. Little known facts. I don't know why you guys didn't get out of that racket, because now half of you guys are doing sex ed anyway, so it's a full circle.
Yeah, that's right. I do teach the sex ed, so there you go.
Yeah. Little known facts about vibrators here at 907. So we did that. That was the first thing, is that there's a limit. Don't rely on your therapist. It's almost like the Lou Reed. You can't depend on your family. You can't depend on your friends, you know. Bust a load of faith to get by. And so we did the limits of that. Then we talked about the limitations of matter. We got into the meat with the chiropractors, and, of course, that went swimmingly. There's nothing in chiropractic that's going to help you. And basically, chiropractors are sort of, I don't know if it's ingrained in the profession, but it's ingrained in the application of it to avoid subjects that they can't stick a fork in because they believe it, but they can't espouse it. So limitations of matter, we talked about that with the chiropractors and how that principle has been sort of underserved in the profession. And so the perception of the field as a whole is fix me, fix me, fix me. We're sort of like, you know, metaphorical veterinarians, fix me, fix me, fix me, instead of free me, free me, free me, which is a whole different animal. So then we got into the limitations of sports and entertainment and media with our friend Sid Rosenberg and Mike Silva and the scary Harry Bavarian, who was talking from a spider hole that evening, as I am right now, probably, in the echo. You'll hear me later, tinningling my way along.
You sound okay, though. Who knows?
See, I always sound fine during the show. It's the replay. I sound like I'm talking like, okay, now the next thing we're going to talk about. Yeah, that's what I sound like.
Hmm.
Figure that out. Live help, wherever you are. Pinheads. So we got into that. So that was like the third layer of this thing. And then we made a little sharp left, and we started talking with the life coach last week about some of these distinctions between, you know, when you're giving advice that has some type of problem-solving mode to it, or when you're just providing information for someone and letting them kind of find their own way. And so we had the fearless living situation last week, which was, you know, dicey.
Mm-hmm.
But we got through it. But the thing is, like all of this stuff kind of bounces around. It comes back to there's a big dead animal in the room. I think it's an elephant, but maybe you don't.
It could be because, you know, I told you about the hail.
Yes, exactly. Oh, you're saucy tonight. 909, second reference to genitals from Professor Fowl.
Fever will do that, you know.
Fever. She's got the fever. Deco fever. is that when you're dealing with these things, there's always a gap between what's happening and how you're describing it. And this is where we get into the limitations of language, which, you know, is somehow people kind of intellectually understand it, but they don't quite apply it to their personal life. So even when it comes to something as simple as body work, you go in and get a massage or something like that, and they usually have a little picture of you. Where does it hurt? You know, you draw your little picture. When you try and explain your story to somebody else of what's happening in your world, literally, you start using these little fatas things called words, and that's only 7% of the communication, as best you can estimate it. And so what happens is that it only approximates, it only kind of gets a fraction of what's really happening. So you have this map that you're communicating about, this common territory that we're all sharing, and that's where language sort of, you know, is a shortcut. It gives you a substitute of having a real experience. And so the words come across, and they don't always reach the beach of the other person because they don't relate to the lingo. And we're going to get to the lingo tonight because there's a lot of that between the life coaches, the therapists, and all the other people. And the way that you're experiencing things subjectively. See, in the somatics model, you're really not interested in that aspect of the communication. It's just another extension of it. It's almost like if you take all the tactile experiences you have, whether it's something you smell, something you taste, something you touch, it's all kinesthetic in a somatic sense. It's all hitting the body. Something physical is happening. But when you're talking about visual, you could be sitting in a room and you could be imagining yourself on a beach, and you're still having a visual experience of the beach, and your physiology is still reacting to that, even though it's not happening right there in front of you. You're not in physical contact with it. When you're talking about language, heck, you could make up stuff that doesn't even exist. Unicorns, for example. And
yeah,
there'll be pictures that come out of that. Yeah. So it's like with NLP, and we're going to get to linguistic programming as a model and as a modern day representation of some of these things, it's gone through the third or fourth layer of trying to get past this limit of how do we use language effectively, and how do we couple that with the nonverbal communication that we're all doing that's over 90% of what it is we're trying to get across to other people. So we have our guest, Mike LaFrano, who actually, believe it or not, trained me. Ooh, I was trained once, like a little circus tiger.
So what's it like to be the person who trained you?
Well, you'll discover from the voice tone of our EXO guest, it takes away a little of your punch, a little of your fastball. You're never quite the same. You walk a little different. Yeah, I went through him like a shard to glass, believe me. It was a time in my life that I look at as a pivot point between poor and really poor. Yes. This is one of the reasons I was drawn to NLP was because I was dealing with the other than conscious aspect of the person's body on the table. Someone's getting on a chiropractic table. Say someone's got wicked low back pain like I had the last couple of weeks, right? They're describing it. It hurts over here, here, here. And the chiropractor's trained to see the entire person. It's like you're looking at the human body, it's like you see an H and you see an X. That's all your brain can handle after 40 months in Iowa. X and the H, X and the H. The H is for when they're static and not moving, to make sure that they're distributing their weight properly. And the X is when they are dynamically moving, shifting their weight from one leg to one arm and so forth, like a little figure eight, right? So you look at that on the table, and you're trying to basically put together that image in front of you. And so what happens is that you're not dealing with things that are conscious to the client at all. And they're basically not really conscious to the doctor at a certain point. It's like when you're driving, everything becomes kind of second nature. So NLP gave me a way to look at the way people were responding to questions. So if someone says, I feel pain, and I say, describe it to me, and their eyes went up, I knew they were getting visual information and not kinesthetic information. So I knew there was something screwed up in the works because they were taking a picture of the pain. And so it was almost like having a TV in your head, and the only channel was pain TV. So they were only looking at the pain. Yeah, right. So psychologists aren't paying attention to that for the most part. So I was looking at how I get at this information. So NLP gave me a way to have a normal conversation with someone they used to call it conversational hypnosis, and you would change the way you would ask a question, you would change the way that you would look for responses or the way you stood in front of the person, because if you're looking at someone, to their right is their future, so to your left is their future. So if you motion with your left hand away from their body towards the side, to the right side, all the information they're going to access for the answer is going to come from their future. If you do it the other way, they're going to go into their past. So someone that, say, has a phobia, and you're waving your left arm, there's no fear on that side of their body. So all of a sudden, they don't talk like they're phobic.
Uh-huh.
I'm pausing. And the catch is made at the warning track. Yes.
Uh-huh.
So neuro-linguistic programming, in and of itself, is a bridge between the philosophy that's talking about communication and the psychological ramifications of it. And it's, you know, if you've never heard of NLP, you know, I'm going to give you like a minute and a half. I'll go to the wiki page here. It's an unbelievable, really good wiki page on NLP here. It's called Worldview and Working Model of Neuro-Linguistic Programming. Unbelievable wiki page. Maybe we'll post it up there in the on the on the Blog Talks channel in a couple of hours, and we get done with this. So what it says here is basically that what neuro-linguistic programming is trying to get at is there's a natural self-taught expertise. You know yourself better than anybody. And the modeling process that comes up, all the habits that we have, are used repeatedly until they don't work. So it's a really pragmatic approach to being able to communicate to yourself better and to other people better. So the history of it really goes back to the 70s, and it's sort of one of these things where it kind of started with two guys and kind of branched out really quickly. John Grinder and Bandler, Dan Bandler, started it out. And for the most part, what those guys were looking at was the combination of how language affected the neural aspect of the way somebody communicates. So if I say the word chair to you, you're going to represent chair in your head, all chairs that you've experienced. But if I put the chair out by the garbage, how would you describe it now? So it was all about context with language. All right? So when you're dealing with this stuff, the philosophy was about trying to get those two disciplines together. And for the most part, in the 70s, it was more about the programming part, more about looking at things almost like the way cybernetics looks at it as a feedback loop. And this goes all the way back to like things like general semantics and stuff the audience can care less about. So the epistemology of NLP went sort of like this. This is right off the wiki page. And this is what Richard Bandler was talking about in Frogs and the Princess. He says, what we essentially do is pay very little attention to what people say they do and a great deal of attention to what they actually do. We know that our modeling has been successful when we can systemically get the same behavioral outcome or results as the person we've modeled, and when we teach somebody else to get the same outcomes in a systemic way, that's an even stronger test. So it's all about transferring skills and transferring awareness, not on an intellectual level. This is my life. I've got people calling in. I've got all kinds of things blinking all over the computer, and I'm trying to talk here.
Mm-hmm.
So what NLP was good at was it took the people that were the best communicators that they could find, and they modeled them. They broke them down. So guys like Milton Erickson in hypnosis, Virginia Satir in family therapy, Fritz Perls in psychology, you might have heard of him. These guys, here I go in the spider hole. These guys were experts at being able to get information from conversation, from just conversation. Because people get defensive. It's almost like with a lawyer. They get very kind of squirrely when they have people asking them questions about the way they act, and almost like the way psychologists have to deal with sometimes when they're trying to get memory out of somebody, like what happened. People are traumatized psychologically. They don't have all the information sometimes. And so NLP used things like eye accessing cues and the predicates, the way they would use it. Are they talking in a kinesthetic language, or are they talking more in a visual language? Things, little subtle things like that. And all this stuff got added up and compiled together, and people got really turned on by it because it was making rapid change. And one of the things NLP was really good at with in terms of affecting people is that it can make change in the moment. And this was something that was foreign in psychology and behavioral therapy and in body work, definitely, because everything was longitudinal. Everything was going to heal. Time heals all wounds. Well, what if you don't have time as a resource? What if you have to heal in this space, in this moment, that doesn't have a duration? And really, psychologically, all we experience is the moment, the now, all that kind of, you know, woo kind of stuff. And so, long story short, NLP grew because it got results. It didn't matter that no one could explain it. Kind of like, you know, chiropractic started in the beginning. They couldn't explain why people were getting better. When people, you know, they thought it was the cure for deafness, for God's sakes, because the first guy that got adjusted was deaf.
Oh,
well, we just, yeah, exactly. See, you got your vibrator story. I got that one. There's a little hand up on my...
I saw that.
What does that mean?
I think it wants to slap you. I don't know.
I don't know. As long as I can, I'm still recording, I guess. I don't know what that means, a little hand.
That pops up every once in a while. We should probably ask them just out of curiosity.
Yeah, little known facts of the Blog Talk experience.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's roll the interview because we're getting a little late here. And the first part of the interview, you got it all wired together, or are we just going to start and stop it?
I fixed it. It can just go right through.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right,
thanks.
So without further ado...
I am that good.
Well, you know what? I'm letting you be that good tonight.
Thanks.
So we will roll tape with Mike LaFrana, and we'll come back to kind of review things. And like I said, the important thing to listen to in this interview is not so much the actual words as what he's saying. Is if you can close your eyes and let his words hit the body, because he's talking in a trance loop, and he's doing it to me as he's answering the questions, even though he trained me. It's really scary, and it affected me. I went out like a light after this interview was over. Go ahead, roll it.
All right, once I start this, if it's too
long,
I'm going to stop it. Go ahead.
Well, that's only like 25 minutes. Let's see. Before I do that, we need the proverbial Costas send-off here.
Well, go ahead.
Good riddance, fuckface.
There you go.
So long, you fetus-faced windbag. Good luck managing a Denny's douchebag.
That's my little homage to the Phillies.
That's nice. So. All right, I'm going to start this. If it's too low, I'm going to stop it and start it a little louder, but I think it's going to be...
All right.
It should be all right.
Clicky.
Here we go.
Okay, without further ado, joining us from NLP Behavioral Consultants of New Jersey, a mouthful, is my old... they were masters at getting people to go into these ambiguities that language offers you because you say things with a different tonality or even the Milton model, you know, going into questions and things, are you here with me now, that kind of stuff. And the mind has to track that, and this is one of the things I think that in working with kids, we've worked with a lot of kids over the years that have, you know, learning disabilities, behavioral issues, things like that, and their capacity to sort of not listen, tune things out, you know, and I don't know if you caught this stuff the last couple of days on the Michael Savage show about the labeling of children with autistic behaviors, and he's really harsh about it, you know, calling them brats and stuff. But the tendency is to label the kid and not look at what the kid's trying to get accomplished. And one of the things NLP taught me over the years is don't link the person to their behavior. Make the person separate from their behavior so that you can look at the behavior and see what's the usefulness of this, of what they're doing. What are they trying to communicate even within their miscommunication? So I think one of the things that NLP has been sort of like, and this is one of the things kind of turning the corner here, getting into the popularity of NLP. When it was in its peak of popularity, it was used in things like...
All right, the file is doing something weird here, and I'm not sure what. So,
are you surprised?
No. So why don't you talk for a second, and let me see what the F is going on here.
All right, well, we were starting to get into this. I'll go back to this a little bit now, might as well. Yeah, this Michael Savage thing, if you listen to it the last couple of days, basically what's happening is autism as a movement has gotten to the point where now that label has become a prize for a certain segment of the population, because in order to get the modalities and the interventions and the support the special needs families need, they have to allow their kid to go through this process of going being evaluated to see where they are on the spectrum. And then, of course, the special needs community moves you around the little monopoly board and doles out the therapies. And so there's not enough funding to take care of these kids that legitimately need help. And so what happens is you get a lot of squirrels in there that are on the border that don't quite belong, but they shove them in there anyway. And so what happens is that those kids are pickled just as well. And what happens is the families now become hypervigilant to make sure that these kids are still getting, you know, the support they perceive that they need. But a lot of times it's just a map. And again, the thing is what happens is that the same thing happens with physical ailments. Think of things like asthma. There's a lot of kids walking around that are asthmatic, but they don't have asthma, but they get medication for asthma. Mm-hmm. So it's the same thing with autism. You can be autistic but not have autism. And those little subtle differences in the language is when you label stuff and act like Aristotle, and everything you name is a thing and it's real, it doesn't change. It's static. And you know that perception, it becomes something that person identifies with and internalizes. And then what happens is they're close enough. They round it off. They actually become what it is that they've been labeled by. So someone that says, I'm depressed, well, they label themselves as being depressed, and they don't put a context on that depression. And over time, they become a depressed person. So it's like it's self-fulfilling philosophy or whatever. I came up with
the prophecy.
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, I need a little more juice in my brain here.
Mm-hmm.
Still in the trance for Mike. So the whole point of that, well, I'm getting at with this autism thing with what's his name with Savage, as the mentally tumor runners on and grist my freaking hide here. Is that he wasn't really trying to mock the families as much as he was trying to mock the process that the MDs set up to label these kids, because legitimate kids are not getting their needs met, and the kids that are acting like and close to but not quite are getting, you know, pickled. So what's happening is that there's a lot of unscrupulous operators out there that benefit from people being labeled like this. And so the whole industry is driven by numbers. So if you have enough numbers, you get more funding. So there's a kind of a silent agenda there to continue to label people. They do it with the elderly people too. I mean, you used to just get senile. Now you have what? You have like a five or six different things with dementia and Alzheimer's, and every single one of those labels is a static label that starts to become very generalized. I mean, just think of something as general as acquired immune deficiency syndrome. You can catch a lot of people in that net. It isn't just people that have HIV. People have a lot of autoimmune disorders, and that gets funding. So this process of using this old map, the old way of doing things, where whatever I name it is, becomes very. You make less distinctions, and it's more difficult to adapt, and the system starts to become very top heavy with a lot of mislabeled individuals, and then of course, who benefits? The people that labeled them, and who suffers? The people that got mislabeled because they believe it. Yeah, and so what happens is the educator has a different definition for, say, something like ADD than a clinician would, or someone that's working with brain science would, or someone that's working with developmental delayed kids would. And so all those different kind of versions of the story get glommed together, and you have advocacy groups, and you have lobbyists, and you have all this stuff going on. So Savage was trying to like he says, boldly awaken the parents to say, don't let your kid get labeled by this process, because the movement in autism is to get early diagnosis, and diagnosis, you know, to know, is one of these assumptions, because the way they evaluate autistic behavior is very subjective at that age. And so, you know, it's not like everyone's running out getting fMRIs and looking at blood flow in the brain and all kinds of stuff. They're just looking at kids that aren't progressing, meeting their milestones, and they're moving them into the spectrum. And you have low-functioning LD kids getting in there. You have kids that have, and then you're familiar with this, Val, the things like, you know, oppositional defiant disorder, and
mm-hmm.
the kids that get more violent, they're not necessarily autistic, but they're lumped in. The Asperger kids are lumped in. And so what happens is that all these different gradations of similar ways of adapting, similar ways of behaving get modeled, and so it all becomes one big strip of peanut butter. Everybody's stuck to it. And that's what Savage was trying to talk about, but that message got lost because he went off and he acted like a belligerent onto that he is. What's happening, of course, is everyone's after Savage instead of saying, are we over-medicating these kids? Are we over-diagnosing this and generalizing it too much? Can we be more specific? Can we come up with a different set of criteria so we really focus on the kids that need this type of approach or that type of approach? And I don't think it's really been communicated well on either side about that, because one side's trying to get lobbying and trying to get funding, and one side's trying to say, resist the temptation to get diagnosed. So it leaves the public in no man's land, because the parents aren't equipped to do it. And if they can't really line up with the conventional healthcare system or the educational system, they're forced into woo land where there's no map. You're just basically walking around. And, of course, you know, the woos take the same thing and they go, it's not autistic, that's an indigo child, you know, and they go there. So that kid's really gifted and talented, and they're channeling things from other dimensions. They're really angels without wings, and you're off on that tact. So to me, it's like that's why I like NLP, because it's like the movements in positive psychology where you're not pathologizing the condition, where you're not labeling, where you're looking at performance and you're looking at process and you're looking at a feedback loop that's context sensitive, not content sensitive. So where are we on the upload?
I'm uploading it again in its entirety, and then we'll have to
start and stop.
I don't think we can. I think once we stop, we stop, but we can get most of the interview in that way.
That's not going to... Well, we're going to run out of time. Unless you get up there in the next minute or two.
I'm trying.
Trying is what we always do here at Naked Selma.
We try well.
We try. We try very hard.
That's right. Well, let me see what happens here. Just continue.
Yeah. So, like I said, you know, with NLP, the thing is that what you can get at with that system is sort of like a cross section of your worldview, and we talk about this in our work. And actually, we did promise you last week. I might as well tell you, the S list is available.
That's right.
A little ebook is available, and you can go to Naked Soma Nation.com. It'll be up there later, or you can go to somaspace.org/S, as in Soma, listed with a D, .html, and you can give your email address, and then you'll get the link to the free PDF. It's about 56, 57 pages long, and it'll take you through all four domains, because, again, everything we're talking about here is about identity. So behavior becomes something. The more you do a behavior and it becomes sort of a base behavior, you identify yourself by the way you do things. NLP, because it's so focused on looking at how someone communicates and what they actually do rather than what they describe it with language, you're creating a closer and closer way to evaluate things more accurately, because you're not going on the verbal component alone. You're coupling it with performance and saying, can they get what they said done? And that say-do ratio is an important thing. That's why NLP has been so popular in things like sales and marketing and in business in general, because a lot of people talk a lot of talk, but they don't follow through. NLP is a follow-through based method. Can you deliver what you said you were going to deliver to me? And then I can develop trust, and I can actually rely on your words as much as your actions. And NLP has that sort of binding effect on things where psychology doesn't. Psychology is much more inductive. It's much more about what you meant to say, what you should have said, what you could have said. That's why everyone's flat on their back on the couch, you know, second-guessing themselves, where in NLP, it's a short-term therapy. It's much more about clarifying and getting yourself back on your own two feet and being independent with the way you communicate. So are we anywhere close to hitting play?
Well, it's processing, so...
The processing?
Yeah.
All right, well, the microphone...
After you upload it, it processes.
Well, the Michael Flano interview will be posted in its entirety on Blog Soma, no doubt. We'll get most of it done here tonight, but I it's something bugging me about trying to just, you know, hope we stop at 10. So we'll probably stop at around, you know, 5 or 6 to 10 to close up the shoe once we get it marching on. But Flano's interview, basically, just to give you guys a little overview, is his training began when NLP began. And so it was very raw and very kind of experimental and extremely variable. And so when you came through NLP, it wasn't like you were going through a training to be an acupuncturist or any other kind of modality-based therapy. You were getting information, and how you applied it was going to depend on you individually. So some people took it into business. Some people took it into the healing arts. Some people took it into education. Some people took it into spirituality. It went every different direction, because where does language go? It goes everywhere. So that's why the entire community of NLP was so hard to identify, and that's why if you walked up on the street and said, I'm an NLP practitioner, we talked about it in the interview you'll hear, no one knows what that is. Like like someone today says, you know, I'm a somatic educator. You're, you know. But if I say I'm a Pilates instructor, that's specific. So that's the difference, is that the language about and around NLP, it's funny, doesn't really assist NLP in communicating what it is. So here you have a whole discipline that's all about communication, and the information about it itself doesn't communicate what it is. Fascinating.
It is ready.
All right, then. Without further ado, I give you Mike Lefrano.
There'll be one more ado. Hold on.
One more ado? There's always one more ado.
Wait. Let me find it on here. Okay, I got it. Ready?
Press play of mercy. Okay, without further ado, joining us from NLP Behavioral Consulting in New Jersey, my old instructor and guru of the NLP terrain, Michael Lefrano, joining us here on Naked Soma. Hello, Michael.
Hello,
greetings,
how are you?
Greetings.
Hey, okay, we finally got here.
Yeah.
So this is one of those things where I guess we're all kind of sitting outside the cage a little bit and kind of putting the beast that is NLP in the cage and kind of poking it with sticks for a minute. So just for the listener's benefit, because you've been in this the longest, what do you think the most significant change has been in the way NLP is presented, delivered, and practiced in the last, say, 15, 20 years?
That's an interesting question, because I really don't know how they're presenting it lately. It's been more advanced as far as how the brain processes, and the person that's the most, I think, the most on top of that is Robert Dilts. But what happens with the NLP community, it comes out and then goes back into underground and then comes back out again. It's pretty big right now in Europe, but right now in the United States, from what I'm understanding, it's not as prevalent as it was years ago. Came back out in the 80s and went back down underground again, and there are very few people that I have found that are really as interested in it, because there's other technology out there, and but it's still the basis, and it's still not really prevalent in the corporate world as much as it could be. Because right now I'm doing executive coaching.
For the most part, yeah, it's become embedded in a lot of other things, and it's become sort of like where general semantics was sort of the antecedent to a lot of the cybernetic stuff that then became the antecedent to a lot of NLP, as when it was being kind of just... The structure was being put down in the late 70s, early 80s, when, you know, when Bandler was writing Structure of Magic, things like that. They were using previous incarnations of linguistics, and it was much, much more of a technology that was more based in sort of modeling and sort of emulating other things that had worked and advancing it, where now it seems like it's sort of gone into, it's laced itself into so many different things, that it almost NLP as itself doesn't stand free and independent of other things. It's sort of part of the glue that is, it's in therapy, it's in education, all the things that it applied to. It seems like it's sort of over there now. It's less centered. It's more decentralized. I guess that's what you're telling us.
Right. It's not as there's a few centers that are doing it. I know Richard Bandler and John Laval are still working with it, but working with it in their own way. They have modified it. And as Grinder has said, the roots of NLP are extremely important, and a lot of and it's structured. The real roots of a practitioner course are extremely structured, and it gives people the foundation to implement the skills more effectively. And what is happening, just like everything else, you're absolutely right. It's weeded into or branched out, and people are taking pieces of it and using it in their own training and their own way of presenting or doing whatever they're doing in their career. So there is, I've seen pieces of it in some of the coaching, some of the business has been using it. There are people that are using massage therapists that are using pieces of the puzzle. But the real roots of the structure is not really there. It's they're taking what they can use and putting it wherever they can, wherever is needed. So
here's one of the things, the thread, I'll just take on that point there, because I just kind of parachuted off of it when you were talking. Sorry to interrupt you there, but positive psychology has become like the big in thing, the science of happiness, all that stuff, and Sugarman's work. What was the other one? We'll get to you in a minute there, Shrinko. and NLP has always been a modality that it talks about people not being broken and having resources within and the requisite variety and all those sort of the tenets of the philosophy of NLP. Because, you know, Bandler used to walk in, and you go from your own training, you know, whether it was apocryphal or not, he'd walk in and deal with schizophrenics and deal with people that had major mental disorders and was more interested in their map than in the label that the map was given by the conventional modality. So how does NLP apply to things like positive psychology? Is what they're doing just a more contextualized version of NLP in psychology, or are they sort of independent ways of looking at the same thing?
Well, they're taking pieces of it, but I don't know. I'm not familiar too much with that. They are, from what I've understand, they are taking pieces to the puzzle, but the interesting thing about anything like psychology and psychiatry, it's keeping people totally are not into really doing short-term interventions. It's more of long-term, and it's just like the pharmaceutical companies or the way the medical system is designed to keep you codependent on whoever or drug, doctor, or whatever you're using. And that's the same thing with psychology as far as I know it. Whether this new psychology that you're talking about or is out there, are they working with short-term interventions and short-term therapy, so to speak, to get people through these issues quickly and having them move on? That is a question that they have to ask themselves, and that's an independent question to each individual psychologist, because it's still backed up with making money. Just like the NLP, a lot of the people that are involved with NLP know that short-term, they work with people on short-term interventions and getting people through these issues a lot quicker. They have to do something else to compensate because it's not a long-term care. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, this is one of the things we were talking about in terms of applying NLP. Like you say, if people practice it formally, whether they're a therapist or not, or whether they're a counselor or not. Like last week we were talking about life coaching and we're trying to make a distinction between life coaching and psychotherapy. Like from our experience in discussing it and from Val's experience in teaching it, there's a lot of things as far as the setup goes. And the setup in NLP is that this is not long term. This is here to get some skills sharpened and get some awareness and then go out and use it. Where in psychotherapy, like you're saying, even in body work, chiropractic, perfect example on my side, it's a lifelong thing. People say look at therapy now as basically part of their wellness. I go to my therapist, and it just doesn't work that way in NLP because you're not coming to the therapist to or going to the NLP practitioner for the same reason you would go to the therapist. So just I'm trying to make distinctions here. You've seen the evolution of life coaching, I'm sure, that everyone's a life coach now pretty much. And do you think a large percentage of the life coaches have come across some NLP? Because we're going to get to Tony and some other guys in a minute. Or do you think mostly that model that Thomas Leonard put out is, and we saw Rhonda Britton's model last week a little bit, is just a very weak or loose representation of some of the meta model and things that you've seen?
Well, he's absolutely right.
As far as
coaching, they will take pieces. Remember, the coaching, here's the difference. Coaching has their own set of, or format, their own set of structure that they're going to follow through, and then they add NLP to it.
Are they doing it actively? That they know they're doing the NLP, or they just
some of them do and some of them don't. They may have taken, I don't know how long they've taken. Some people that have taken practitioner courses may have incorporated it in there, but there's another piece to the puzzle. And a colleague of mine he went into life coaching because he wanted to get out of counseling, but he's doing pure NLP in his life coaching. So the difference is you're a coach using NLP, or you are an NLP practitioner using NLP to coach people out. There's two different things.
Mm-hmm.
It's which is the highest criteria. I'm a coach, and I have learned coaching skills, and I use NLP within those coaching skills, or I am a certified practitioner in NLP, pure NLP, to help people get to where they got to go. Two different modalities. Do you understand the difference?
Yeah, I think the public, yeah, from the professional side, yeah, because believe me, we change the bunting on our business cards. It seems like I just changed it a couple weeks ago. Because it because what happens is that the public has a perception of you, you know, and you've done this game with people too, word association. You know, you say doctor, you say dog, and people get an image of their head based on their own experiences. You say chiropractor to somebody, they grab their back. We did one a couple weeks ago with a bunch of chiropractors, and Dr. Kent was on the show, Christopher Kent, and he said that, you know, he'd done it in airports and stuff and introduced himself as a chiropractor. People start feigning back pain because I'm glad I didn't say I was a proctologist or a gynecologist. You know, go into that mode.
That was
so with funny. NLP, I think, I think with NLP, people don't really have a set reference point or a default setting to go to when someone says I'm an NLP practitioner. I think to this day, if you said that to somebody, they would say, what the heck is that? That's your attitude?
Well, that's the reason why I changed from the center, from the NLP Awareness Center to NLP Behavioral Consultants.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it links it to behavioral change. And that has made a big difference in my business. I have right now, I have three offices. One office my wife is using right now, Mickey, and she's using it with Natural Force Healing, and she does the NLP. And then I have the NLP Awareness Center in Toms River, and I also have the NLP Behavioral Consultants working with what we call the CDR Center, which is cellular detox and rejuvenation, where we do dark field and where live blood assessment, BTA, you know, urine and saliva testing for pH and frequency machines in the sauna. But
wow.
At the same time, if the body isn't linked with the mind and they can do all the healing that they want to do, you know, with the health changes, if the mind isn't congruent with that, they can sabotage all the health strategies that they're using. So within the three centers, yes, I have changed it, but I'm still doing the NLP behavioral or the consulting as a foundation and a root, because without it, you know, without the mind and the emotions and alignment, nothing else is going to really work.
Hmm. And do you find people in that setting where they're getting all the biofeedback and all the sort of external evidence that things are really changing, that the NLP, the language, the more the sort of low-tech end of it has more validity there, or you think it's more a case of the person's coming in with that purpose and that's what they get?
You better redefine that one. That was a good one, but I got to follow that one.
Yeah, you want to do a trance on me there. Is it, someone walks into a setting and they know they're going to get the cellular detox, they're going to get all these bells and whistles.
Right.
The NLP is a facilitator for that, where if someone's coming down to the other center, the old center, for behavior work, it's more low-tech. And it's more like the change is global, physiological, systemic, and profound, but there's
right.
no external evidence. It's all subjective. It's like, yeah, I feel different now. And it's like they're not measuring it with the same parameters. Like we talk about in somatics, this concept of a sense of coherence. When people are in a situation and they can't manage it, they can't comprehend it, and it has either too much meaning, not enough meaning, or the inappropriate meaning, they lose coherence, and they lose coordination. It's just, they uncouple, so to speak, mind and body uncouple. So they'll drop out of their primary domain. They won't be able to function in using familiar patterns, and they have to basically kind of break apart. And in Val's experience in using the domains to communicate that, there's a difference when someone takes something from their personality that they think that's them, or when they take something from outside themselves and say, I have a preference for that, I like that. And the affinity that you're trying to get at here is that most people are sorting for external. evidence that things are changing, and they don't know how to evaluate the internal stuff. So I'm just curious, if someone goes to the center with all the bells and whistles, if the NLP has more validity there, because they're getting the feedback right away, like we see sometimes on the
Yeah, there is a change in people. The behavioral part does work because it adds to that, and they do get evidence because we could do the dark field before and after, and we could see a difference in the way the blood is, whether it's coagulating or not. So we do get our evidence there. As far as the office in Toms River, when I'm working with people, yeah, there is evidence, but the evidence will have to come, you're right, because it's not an instant where they're seeing an external, except that they know internally that they feel different. You're absolutely right on that. The other thing is how their environment has changed and how they have created their environment the way they really wanted, and seeing changes, how they're responding to people and things like that. It's still, that's happened. Or they've seen that they've made more money now because the conflict that they had inside about, let's say, money has changed, and all of a sudden their environment, they're bringing in more money. So there is external references, but it's not immediately from the session. But in the other center, there is ways of testing that. Yeah, we could test that through dark field. Now, my wife...
You can test it on site, but if someone's looking for the money thing, like the same kind of behavioral change external, are they going to come in now that they've aligned themselves with that behavior and they're out there doing those different behaviors? When they come in, say the next time they come in, their pre-test is going to be more or as coherent as their post-test was when they first had the stuck pattern. So it's like they're progressing exponentially higher as the system moves into more harmony with itself. Is that what you're suggesting? Like they come back
right.
in and like the social external and the physical external start to become sort of like they track together? So they behave
right.
better and more aligned than their coherence is, it sticks. Okay. Because
there's
stuff with NLP no one believes.
What? Yeah, and the health does change. There's a lot of research. There's what we call terrain loss.
Biological terrain?
And
yeah.
What?
Biological terrain you're talking about?
Yeah, the external terrain. Well, there's a conflict, and there's also conflict. So that means if there's something, no, it's not terrain, it's territorial loss. So if anything external that's a territorial loss, there is a lot that goes on within the body. That could be loss of a spouse or losing money, losing a house. That territorial loss is a conflict, and it comes out into some kind of a symptom in the body, as well as conflict. And conflict, is, there's a, an MD, I think you, Healing Back Pain, Serrano, I think his name is.
Yeah, sure.
And he's always talked about cognitive therapy, and even in his books he mentions it because there is a generated disc and ailments. So once the conflict is resolved, then it's easier for, let's say, a chiropractor, and that's why I have a lot of referrals from chiropractors, because the adjustments don't hold all the time because the emotional conflict is still there. Correct or no?
Yeah, this is something like, and in training chiropractors or in delivering that philosophy to them, where you're talking about vitalistic processes, that intent matters, dreams matter, imagination matters, all the stuff you can't stick a fork in has a profound influence on, you know, I used to talk about treating the meat, and they put this sack of meat on the table, and they're just going to, like, thump forever and drive a sports car. I think they're doing anybody any favors. But actually what they're doing is they're making the compensation and the body's defense mechanisms sharper, because the body takes it as an outside trauma then. It takes it almost like as a way to reinforce or make the fist tighter to protect the shell a little more. And with NLP, you guys get in with something as gentle as an anchor. And it could be a spatial anchor. It could be, you know, it could be an anchor just in an inflection in a voice or an embedded command, all these little tools that NLP uses. And, you know, some of the greats that NLP drew its strength from, like Virginia Satir or Fritz Perls or even a Bateson, they were masters at getting people to go into these ambiguities that language offers you, because you say things with a different tonality or even the Milton model, you know, going into questions and things, are you here with me now, that kind of stuff. And the mind has to track that. And this is one of the things I think that in working with kids, you work with a lot of kids over the years that have you know, learning disabilities, behavioral issues, things like that. And their capacity to sort of not listen, tune things out, you know, and I don't know if you caught this stuff the last couple of days on the Michael Savage show about the labeling of children with autistic behaviors, and he's really harsh about it, you know, calling them brats and stuff. But the tendency is to label the kid and not look at what the kid's trying to get accomplished. And one of the things NLP taught me over the years is don't link the person to their behavior. Make the person separate from their behavior so that you can look at the behavior and see what's the usefulness of this, of what they're doing. What are they trying to communicate even within their miscommunication? So I think one of the things that NLP has been sort of like, and this is one of the things kind of turning the corner here, getting into the popularity of NLP. When it was in its peak of popularity, it was used in things like sales. This is why Tony rose to power, you know, in the mid to late 80s, the Gordon Gekko era of NLP, so to speak. And you were there in the beginning when it was much more of a sort of an underground operation. What was it like for you, you know, going through that process from, may say, early 80s to mid 90s, you know, the peak of its power, and then that transition back into sort of like a an open-ended interdisciplinary modality like it is now? What was that like for you going on that ride of like, here I am in this little group of people, and it's Bandler, crazy Bandler, doing all these crazy things, and all of a sudden it's Tony on infomercials 24 hours a day. Did everyone think that it was all going to go up for everybody? Or everyone was going to get a piece of the pie? Or what was that like?
All right. We're all right, running out of time. So.
Yeah, the rest of the, like, the whole thing will be posted up on Blog Soma. We'll probably put the link over here on the Blog Talk side so you guys can take a look at that. And, you know, really we were finishing up at that point. But Michael made a lot of points in there. I just want to kind of gloss over a couple of them. Is that, and towards the end of the interview we get into it a little more specifically. But the reason why NLP never becomes something solid is because in its design, it's just like open source is on the web. It's designed to be a conduit for other types of communication to travel over. So if you're doing hypnosis or therapy or body work or whatever it is that's the vehicle, like having the role individually and saying, I'm going to be your counselor, or I'm going to be your therapist, or I'm going to be your practitioner, that's the role that the public can see. NLP is embedded inside that, and it's an awareness that you can absolutely transfer to the client, because once they understand that their literal interpretation of their experiences is not complete. It's not the only way to see it. It's not the final way to see it, and it's definitely not the most comprehensive way to see it. It frees them up to understand that there's other input, and they factor in things that they normally don't. And put it in the books!
Wow.
The New York
go.
Mets
Woo-hoo.
Are tied for first right before the show ended. So there you go. There's a little language for you. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. So like I said, the NLP, the limits of language is actually understanding them and being able to acknowledge them in the context of a conversation. So the next time you're in an argument, the next time you're really in struggling with self-doubt, listen back to that and remember what Michael was talking about there, is that there's a deeper physiology. He's talking about cells communicating better because of the way you're talking to yourself in your head. So these things are very powerful, and they go right to the core of your being. And in Soma land, you know, we don't really get into the verbal part of it because we look at it as sort of the thing that reinforces it. So NLP, the model, and NLP, the practice, two different things. That's why you're never going to walk out in the street and say, I need my NLP guy, because it's everywhere. So you have to look for the signatures of NLP in the context of the way people are living, and the way you want to notice it is they don't label you. They don't make things final. They make things something that you could make positive change with, that you can personally measure yourself. All that empowering stuff that the life coaches are talking about with the yada, yada, yada is actually the authentic thing that NLP is talking about. So the links will be up, and you can check that out. And like I said, all feedback is welcome. The new ebook is up. SomaSpace.org.
Wait.
I'm Mr. Murgatroyd.
Okay.
SomaSpace.org / S as in Sam, listed with a D, .html. All right? Also, the link will be up there, too. Go over to Naked Soma Nation. Join the conversation over there. It'll be posted there. You go right to it and get you guys studying this, because I think next week we're going to talk a little bit about mind control.
Ooh.
If I can fetch me a scientist from San Diego. and see if we could talk about how that's influencing things, because one of the biggest undersold conspiracies in the last 20 years is the influence of Prozac on the national psyche. And so we're going to get off the couch next week with that, hopefully with our friend Dave Goodman. So for everybody here at Naked Soma, it's been a charm. We got a win tonight in the hour, so
yep.
I'm happy with that. All things are free and easy. And let's see, I'll send you out with We're out. We're done?
We're done.
Well, that was easy.
Yes,
well, then travel light.
Yeah, do that.
See you next week.
Bye.